Welcome to the Morning Magazine on KGNU Community Radio. It's July 7th of 2023. I'm your host, Jack Armstrong. As you know, we are in the middle of our annual summer fun drive. You just heard from Kira Zizzo. And before we start the show, we would like to remind you that you make this show possible, so you can plug in every morning and listen to local and regional news. If you haven't donated already, the time is now to donate. Call 303-449-4885 or go online at kgnu.org. Up first on today's show, we hear from Greater Public's Jay Clayton about the unique set of challenges posed against charitable giving and radio. Then it's the Nature Almanac. And finally, Sports Talk with Jimmy. After that, it's Connections with Joel Edelstein. This morning, he talks with the authors of the groundbreaking new book, Let This Radicalize You, Organizing the Revolution of Reciprocal Care. Then, at 9:30, it's the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still coming up, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Poor Jaijunki.
A federal judge is recommending that the U.S. Supreme Court approve a water-sharing settlement proposed last month. The settlement would recognize the use of a water gauging station near El Paso, Texas, that will help ensure New Mexico is properly sharing the resource with its neighbor. Under the agreement, New Mexico would also pay farmers to leave their fields barren and reduce water usage by improving infrastructure. According to the Associated Press, U.S. Circuit Judge Michael Malloy filed a report this week, calling the settlement between Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas fair and consistent with water-sharing agreements of recent decades. Tensions between the three states arose when farmers in southern New Mexico began to use more groundwater as drought conditions worsened. Texas sued New Mexico, claiming that pumping groundwater was taking water from its share of the Rio Grande. As many as 400 property owners will be eligible to receive compensation from the Gross Reservoir Mitigation Impact Fund after Boulder County Commissioners approved direct payments last month for those who are eligible. $4 million out of the $5 million reduced impacts to residents fund will be available for distribution. Each landowner must complete the required paperwork from Boulder County to receive direct payment. The payment is tiered depending on the severity of the property owner's impact from the reservoir's expansion construction. The Gross Reservoir is located in unincorporated Boulder County along South Boulder Creek, southwest of Boulder. Denver Water, who operates the reservoir, is expanding the water storage capacity for greater water resiliency. The Gross Reservoir expansion project began in April 2022. Residents who have completed their paperwork will receive checks from Boulder County in August and September. Some of the homes that were spared by the Marshall Fire in December 2021 may have harbored carcinogens in the form of dust created by the blaze. That's according to a recent study by CU Boulder scientists, which looked at the long-term effects of the wildfire that destroyed over 1,000 homes and buildings and left two people dead. The researchers studied dust particle samples taken from homes left standing in the neighborhoods where others burned. They say they discovered elevated concentrations of potentially harmful materials such as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in air samples and samples from indoor surfaces. The scientists were not certain whether the particles posed a risk to the residents in areas affected by the fire. However, they say the information could help residents in future fires better prepare for moving back into their homes safely. The city of Boulder is conducting maintenance and improvement projects on its downtown parking garages throughout the summer and fall. These projects will involve partial and full closures of the garages. The work includes repairs, power washing, restriping, installation of parking guidance systems, upgrading electronic signs, and transitioning all five garages to a gateless operation for faster entry and exit. The parking garage at 14th and Walnut Streets will be fully closed from July 13th to August 14th, with alternative parking options available nearby. The Randolph Center garage will have a longer closure starting in August, and dates are yet to be finalized. The Community Vitality Department is coordinating with various stakeholders to ensure continued access to public parking during the projects. Oil and gas operator K.P. Kaufman has, for now, avoided a state order to clean up 78 sites and pay a $2 million fine. Kira Zizzo has more.
Denver District Court Judge Andrew Luxon has temporarily blocked the order by state regulators requiring K.P. Kaufman, also known as KPK, to clean up the sites and pay the fine by August 1st. In February, the State and Energy Carbon Management Commission told KPK if it didn't clean up the sites and pay the fine, they would not be allowed to do business in Colorado. KPK sued to block the commission's order, arguing that it denied them due process. KPK also said that if the order went into effect, they could go out of business. KPK has faced multiple violations at its sites. In November of 2021, the company agreed to clean up spills from wells, tanks, and flow lines. An initial $2 million fine was reduced at the company's request. KPK said it couldn't afford to pay over $795,000. After months of delays and conflicts with commission staff overseeing the remediation work, the commission voted to reimpose the $2 million fine. According to the Colorado Sun, in this latest ruling, the judge issued a stay on the cleanup orders and fines until the KPK lawsuit against them can be heard. For KGNU, I'm Kira Zizzo.
The National Weather Service is struggling to communicate severe weather on Twitter. The platform has now put a cap on the number of tweets a non-paying member can view, limiting the ability of the National Weather Service to scan and report weather updates. The turbulence comes as thunder and hailstorms frequent the Front Range, leading to criticisms that the National Weather Service overly relies on Twitter to carry out its services. A new record for most tornadoes in a day was set in Colorado on June 21st, when 36 tornadoes touched down in Logan and Washington counties. Most of the tornadoes were short, weak, and occurred in open space, resulting in minimal damage. The previous record was set in May 2000, with 27 tornadoes in a single day. Today in Denver, it's partly sunny with a high of 79. A 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms is projected for after 2 p.m. In Boulder, it's partly cloudy today with a high of 77 and a chance of severe thunderstorms after 4 p.m. In Fort Collins, it's mostly sunny. The high is 78. Showers and thunderstorms are likely between 4 and 5 p.m. For KGNU, I'm Porja Junkit.
As you hopefully already know, KGNU's annual Summer Fun Drive is happening right now. When it comes to fundraisers, it could be difficult to understand the real impacts of your donation, like this one, but we get that. For the fourth time in four decades, charitable donations dropped in 2022 by close to 4%, and KGNU's Verity Matthews spoke with Jay Clayton of Greater Public, who says the pandemic and inflation have taken tolls on charitable giving across the board, but radio in particular is facing a unique set of challenges.
One of the biggest changes from a radio perspective that has come out of the pandemic is that for many listeners, they're just not commuting every day the way they used to, right? You think about all the stories you hear about people working from home, think about your own circumstances, your friends, your family, colleagues, how many people are still working from home, maybe some of the time, maybe all of the time. And that's time that is taken away from what used to be a daily commute. And that daily commute was often filled with listening to public radio. And because of that strong correlation between listening and giving, when listening goes down for any individual, they tend to give less.
Sure. And so what can you tell us about demographics of folks that are contributing to public or community broadcasting stations?
That's a great question. We know that public radio listeners tend to be very educated, oftentimes coupled with jobs that tend to pay higher than average. And so there's more discretionary spending available to a lot of these people. And the other thing I would say is that if you look at public radio donors as a group, they tend to be older. And that makes a lot of sense when you consider how public radio fits into someone's life and how other things fit into their life. And I think that's true of a lot of nonprofits across the country, again, because it's not so much about the nonprofit and how many people, you know, use it in the case of public radio, It's more a matter of at what point in your life do you tend to have more money to give away?
Philanthropic giving really is evolving with the younger generations who are now inheriting wealth from baby boomers with campaigns such as GoFundMe, more of these direct appeals for very micro-specific causes. When it comes to public radio, community radio, we do tend to make most of our money from our what used to be called pledge drives, are now called either membership drives or fund drives. What, in your opinion, is the trend in giving with regard to those on-air fundraising efforts?
Well, I think on-air fundraising is always going to be important because it's a unique way for us to reach our audience when they are right there. There's also an education component in that, right? When people hear that fundraising, even if they don't happen to be giving to a particular fundraiser that they're listening to, they're learning about how all of this works, how the station that they care about is funded. And that learning could one day lead to giving. But at the same time, on-air fundraisers are going to work for some listeners, but they're not going to work for everybody. I think, as you mentioned, you know, particularly thinking about younger listeners and younger potential donors, they've got more options. They're familiar with a lot of these options, and we need to meet them where they are. So there are all kinds of creative ways that we can explore in connecting with donors, because all these doors have been opened due to advances in technology and developments of social media and things like that, that just didn't exist up until, in relative terms, very recently.
What do you think is the primary reason that people who are listening to public radio, what inspires them to give to their station?
I think when they realize that this programming really has a deep meaning in their own life, when they realize that it's adding value to their life, it's adding joy to their life, it's adding information to their life, it's making their world bigger than it might be otherwise because it's introducing them to people and to ideas, maybe to places that they hadn't heard about. It's introducing them to perspectives that they hadn't thought about before. It's introducing them to music that they hadn't discovered yet and that they might not discover if it weren't for the station that they are listening to. So I think it's that connection. I think it's also when people realize that giving is going to make a difference. You know, maybe it's going to continue to make it possible for you to hear the music that you love discovering, or the news that you depend on. Maybe it's also going to make it possible for somebody else to continue to hear these choices, this music and this news programming that they might otherwise not be able to hear, and they themselves might not be in a position to give right now. Maybe that'll change over time. And so you're helping them too.
Absolutely. And you're speaking to the idea of public media not just being a platform for entertainment, but a resource for people in community to potentially connect with other folks, other institutions, in all different kinds of ways. Maybe they, as you said, don't have the resources to give themselves, but by supporting, folks are really giving other people an opportunity to have access to the information, to the entertainment, to the education, the stimulation that you get from listening to an independent media source. So let's jump from the theoretical, how do we get an individual to support, to when the individual does support, what does giving do for the donor, for the listener?
That's a great question, and I think a great way to ask that question, Verity. I think what it does for the donor is gives them a good feeling that they are supporting something that is important to them personally, something that is important in our communities, something that is important in our democracy. When you look at communities across America, and several significant organizations have been studying this for a while now, you can see a correlation between the decline in local journalism in a community and the decline of civic engagement in that same community, you know, to the point where these organizations that are studying this tie these two things together: the decline of local journalism, local awareness of what's going on at the town hall, what's going on in the school board committee conversations, what's going on in the community in other ways. There's a decline of information about that stuff. And that decline has led to a decline in civic involvement, specifically knowledge about what's going on, awareness, less voting at the local level. You see people still voting in national elections and statewide elections, but often when it comes to local elections, they don't know who the choices are because there's nobody telling them about those choices. And so there's a breakdown in community. There's a breakdown in civics. There's a breakdown in democracy there. So, you know, to turn that around, when somebody supports a station like KGNU, they are strengthening that journalism for your community. They are strengthening that journalism for everyone who lives in that community to make sure that that basic information that we all need as a community, that we all need to function as a community and to function within our democracy and for our democracy itself to function. They're making sure that that basic information stays there. And the other thing I think they're doing is having the goodwill of making sure that not only are they going to have this information, but people who maybe want to give, who value this, who need this service, but can't give right now, they're making sure that it's there for them too.
Jay Clayton of Greater Public, I want to thank you very much for your time, for everything that you do to help us in the industry to be successful and to thrive, and for taking some time to help educate our listeners about the ins and outs of fundraising in community media.
Thank you, Verity. Thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me. And thanks to you and all that you and your team do for your community and your listeners. And thanks to your listeners for making it all possible. We, you know, we are nothing without being together, and the gratitude can't be overstated.
Absolutely. Alrighty, folks, that was Jay Clayton of Greater Public. He is a fundraising, marketing, and public relations professional. And that's the end. Thank you for being here, Jay Clayton.
Thank you.
That was KGNU's Verity Matthews. Now, we're here in the Boulder studio for the Morning Magazine. Up next, we have the Nature Almanac with Shelley Schlender.
It's July. What's happening in the natural world? Here are Boulder naturalists Scott Sievers and Ruth Carol Cushman.
I'm Carol.
I met you, but it's been a long time.
Yeah,
nice to see
good
you
to
again.
See you.
Jennifer Jackson, friend of Scott's.
Jennifer and I had the luck of having jobs where we actually got to do what we love, ecological assessments of bugs to trees to the birds. And we were seeing something over here.
It just flew this way, but I've lost sight of it now.
I see it now. There's a little damsel on a piece of grass.
Where is it?
It's a little bit left of the bindweed flower on a diagonal piece of grass.
Yes, I see it. Boy, they can disappear even when you're pointing right at it.
We've come out to Walden and Sawhill Ponds to look for dragonflies. Dragonflies and damselflies are insectivorous. They eat other insects. Dragonflies hold their wings perpendicular to their body. They look like a small plane.
That makes them much easier to see. Damselflies usually hold their wings backwards, longitudinally to the body, so they look like a little stick. This is one of the more nondescript damselflies. A lot of them are brilliant turquoise blue, but this is sort of a brownish one. Is this a female, Scott?
Yeah, I think it's a female forktail. Very plain compared to the males. but if you look closely, the eyes are emerald green.
It's very pretty, even though it doesn't have any of that brilliant turquoise on it.
Oh, another one arrived.
Oh.
Right in the same place.
Was it a female or
it was a male this time.
Oh, was it bright turquoise?
Yeah, like a Pacific.
Oh, yeah, I see it. Oh, but I've lost it again. How can they disappear so quickly in the foliage?
The damselflies, I always recommend looking below your knees for the damselflies because they're low flyers. Low and slow are the damselflies. Damselflies catch a lot of things off vegetation that they spot. What they'll do is they'll hover and then they'll pounce by hitting a branch or a twig, and that means they plucked something off the grass.
Oh, there you went. Oh, he's back.
Jen, did you find something?
One of the cattails that's broken off. It's fluttering its wings.
Oh, yes, I see it.
It's orange and red, red-faced.
I haven't found it in the binos yet. I'd say it's a small dragonfly compared to the skimmers anyway. There it is, yes. Oh, is that a Halloween pennant?
No, Halloween pennants would be very big. This is smaller. This is a eastern amberwing.
Mm.
Their whole mantra is to look wasp-like, to be left alone. They'll buzz their wings and move their bodies around much like a wasp to discourage things from messing with them.
Mm.
This is a female. She has dark patches on her wings. The male is where the name came from, and their wings are orange all the way through.
Oh, it just flew. She's doing a bit of helicoptering. She's on a broken cattail, but every once in a while she'll helicopter straight up and then come back down.
She's perched, and she'll sally up and catch something and come right back to her perch. That was a great find, Jen.
Yeah.
This is one of the few ponds in all of Boulder County that we can find eastern amberwings, and now a darner has appeared above us, and they are the higher flyers of dragonflies, and they'll fly all day. It's very difficult to even capture them perched. It's foraging back and forth. It's about 8 to 10 feet over us. Oh, that's so cute. A red-winged blackbird female. She looks like a big sparrow, but she has a mouthful of food.
I bet she has a nest or babies down in that plum thicket.
Hear the baby red-winged blackbirds down in the patch of grass there. They're begging and getting fed by mom.
So maybe it'll catch one of our dragonflies.
Yeah. Red-winged blackbirds, they forage a lot on dragonflies. Here comes Dad. The male red-wings are black with a really bright red wing patch. So we're gonna slowly walk by on this trail, the nest, and we'll see if we can see the baby red-winged blackbirds. All the time not trying to approach too close. There's the baby right there. Look at that guy. Yeah, they've just fledged. We'll give them some space.
Ruth Carol Cushman and Scott Sievers are friends and Boulder naturalists.
Beautiful. Another 4th of July has come and went, and I still have all my fingers. God bless America. Hello and welcome to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I, of course, am your host, Jimmy Searfoss, back in the studio today to talk more about what is big in sports here on the Front Range. I hope everyone has had a great 4th of July, and for some, that may have been the biggest highlight of your week. But before America's birthday, there was another annual event here in Boulder, Colorado that had tens of thousands of people celebrating. That's right, Dead & Company made their yearly trip to Folsom Field. Their fans, promptly known as Deadheads, were everywhere. In every corner of Boulder, there was tie-dye shirts as people were celebrating the band's final tour. Now, Jimmy, what does this have to do with sports? Well, a band like this with this kind of following and magnitude needs a venue that can hold such a crowd, so every time Dead & Company comes up to make their trip to Colorado, they play Folsom Field, home of the Colorado Buffaloes. The pictures from these shows are absolutely incredible. There was floods of people packing the stands and the field, and Folsom isn't exactly small either. It's said Folsom Field can pack just over 50,000 people, and that's not including the field itself. You toss in the grass and the deadheads' comfortability with one another, and you can easily toss in another 10,000 onto that total. Dead & Company and the original Grateful Dead have been coming to Boulder for years. As a venue, Folsom Field has held a total of 30 concerts in its time, and the bands are responsible for 14 of them. The Grateful Dead were the second ever concert at the stadium back in 1972, and Dead & Co. has been playing shows in Boulder every year since 2016, with exceptions to the COVID years of 2020 and 2021. Other bands that have also frequented Folsom Field were the Rolling Stones, who alongside Kansas and Eddie Money, played the very first show ever in the stadium back in 1972. Now, looking at these lists of bands that have played at the foot of the Flatirons here in Boulder, it's really hard to not want a time machine. Here are a few other names that have played Folsom Field. The Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, George Thorogood and the Destroyers, Van Halen, The Who, Boston, Paul McCartney, and these guys were all in their prime when they were doing it. These shows were in the 80s and late 70s. Folsom Field actually had a 15-year drought between 2001 and 2016 where it hosted no concerts for no real reason. And since then, the only shows that have been played there are the Dead & Co. shows. Which is odd because there wasn't really a good reason to not have any concerts. Shows like these bring a massive amount of people into town and money for the athletic programs. They draw massive crowds. In fact, it is a concert, not a football game, that is responsible for the capacity record for Folsom Field. Back when Fleetwood Mac came to town, over 61,000 were in attendance. For these three shows over the three-day weekend, the city estimated the town would make between $35 and $50 million, according to a Denver 7 article. It just sounds like good business to me. But no other act has come to Folsom Field but Dead & Co. recently, and now with the band retiring, we could see another concert drought in the future. And that is just about all the time I got for you today here on Sports Talk with Jimmy. I, of course, am been your host, Jimmy Sierfoss. Make sure you tune in next week at this same time for more.